Interview with William Johnston, May 10th, 2010, in New York City by Kenneth Durr. Let's talk a little bit about your earliest background and your father and what you knew about the stock exchange and that kind of life.
Well, my dad was in the business when he graduated from college in 1928. His first job was with Fenner and Bean before it became Merrill Lynch Pierce Fenner and Bean. And the great stories out of my father, who's been dead obviously for 20 years, were the crash, 1929, and his job in those days of doing margin trades in 1929 for Fenner and Bean. So it was the kind of thing, Ken, that I heard around the dining table from the time I was old enough to understand basic English, was talk about Wall Street and what was going on. And after Fenner and Bean, Dad went to Wilmington, Delaware, where he was basically first an assistant branch manager and then a branch manager for F.I. DuPont, which is a firm that's long gone. And he had the pleasure of meeting a fellow in Delaware, in Wilmington, who was married to a DuPont. And the two of them formed a firm called Johnston & Lunger. And it was a sort of quasi full-line small brokerage firm. And then Dad came to New York and became a member of the New York Stock Exchange in 1939, which was the year I was born. He became a member of the exchange, and they did a little brokerage, little trading operation, a two-man mom-and-pop sort of business. So I heard, obviously, all about that. And at, I guess, about age 13 or 14, I got interested in trading. So I borrowed some treasury bills to use as collateral from my mother and basically traded from the time I was 14 years on. I made my first trades at age 14, ridiculous as it is.
And you never stopped?
Huh? And I never stopped.
Now, was your dad a specialist at any point?
He was a specialist at one stage of the ball game, yeah, on the floor of the stock exchange. He was there from, as a market maker, Ken, from maybe the mid-40s until the early 60s. Okay. So he did it for 15, 20 years, but he was a member of the exchange, I guess until the early 70s, and then he sold his seat and basically retired. He'd gone off the floor of the exchange and gone upstairs to do investing versus trading.
Right.
There is a significant difference. He was an investor. He wasn't a particularly good trader. Far better investor.
What makes the difference between the two?
I think there's a time horizon difference. I have found that I was not a particularly good investor, that I was far better in the short-term swings, more emotional, more falling in and out of love with stocks than buying something, having the intelligence to do the research and buy something at a cheap price and hold it for a longer period of time. In fact, if one would make a complaint today about markets, it would be there's too much trading and not enough investing.
Right.
Too much short-term mentality.
Even for people who aren't on the floor of the exchange.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, now, so you were trading all along, apparently. You went to school at Washington & Lee, I guess.
Went to Washington & Lee Business School. I've got a BS degree in commerce. Came out of W&L, did basic training to go into the reserves. Proceeded to get called up for the Berlin call-up in September of 1961. I had taken a course at NYU that summer with the idea of going ahead and getting my master's, my MBA, and that got shot down quickly in the literal, no pun intended, sense. And I got out of the Berlin call-up in August of 62. Betsy and I got married 10 days later, August of 62, and I started in Wall Street right after Labor Day of 62. I started as a clerk on the floor of the exchange.
What company?
In those days, I was working for a joint account, which my father was a part of. But quickly thereafter, I went to work for a friend of his. The firm was another joint account. It was a man named Neville Hart and Ian Murray. There were lots, Ken, there was a total difference. In those days, there were probably 150 specialist firms on the floor of the exchange. Today, there are five. So you had an awful lot of what I use the term mom and pop. They were two people, three people firms. And they would band together in joint accounts to get more stocks and to, you know, merge capital together. We can talk about this as it goes on, because obviously there was a real economy of size. And I'll get to that after 87 happens. Mm-hmm. But that's when the real merger of firms started to take place in mass numbers.
Okay, but you're talking about a lot of small firms.
A lot of small firms.
To do something big, they joined together in a group temporarily.
Exactly.
Okay. So you're working for one of these joint accounts.
Joint accounts.
What was your job?
My job first was as a clerk behind the post of the exchange.
Okay.
And then I was became a member in 64. Bought a seat, borrowed the money, bought a seat on the exchange. And they brought me out in front of the post, this firm, Ian Murray and Neville Hart, they had just gotten a very, very big stock called Tektronix, Tektronix, which was one of the early sort of technology companies that was more gauges and measuring devices than it was pure electronics as we know it today.
Mm-hmm. And that was a period when those sorts of things were just starting to take off.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, this is 64, 65.
Yeah, everything had a name that sounded highly technical.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly.
So that was your first the first stock that you acted as a specialist?
Yeah, I, you know, ran stocks. They had Western Airlines in those days. They had a couple of railroads, a couple of utilities. They didn't have any Dow stocks. They didn't have anything truly enormous, big. And remember, in those days, I saw days of 3 and 4 million shares a day volume. I can remember days of less than a million shares.
Yeah.
For the whole exchange.
Yeah.
Right.
Now they do that
in the first nanosecond.
Right. Right. But of course, it was handled very differently.
Oh, totally different. It was all paper. There were no electronics. Right. It was all paper orders and paper book.
And now I assume there was a pecking order at the exchange, on the floor of the exchange, and you moved in to the bottom rung or something like that.
Yeah, I moved from being a clerk or a trading assistant to being a junior partner, if one wants to call it that, and junior is probably the right word, very junior.
Yeah, which is why you'd get some maybe not the most seasoned issue stocks.
Exactly. Yeah, you would trade the less active or back up the more senior partner in terms of helping him trade the stock.
Well, take me forward a little bit. Talk about how you developed a career in that.
Well, I think what happened was, is ultimately my father came over and joined this joint account. And then in the late 60s, Dad decided he wanted to get out of the business. And the firm was liquidated, our piece of the joint account.
Right.
And I basically took the handful of stocks that were allocated to me. I think there were six stocks that we were, quote, the sole specialist in. And I went to a firm called Mitchum, Jones & Templeton, which was an L.A.-based full-line brokerage firm in those days, a regional firm. along the line of Wedbush and, you know, the E.D. Joneses, the A.G. Edwards, all of those firms that had regional offices. And I became their East Coast in 1970. I ran the East Coast division of Mitchum, Jones, and Templeton as a market maker specialist on the floor of the stock exchange, and was the only non-Californian on their board. It was a public company, publicly traded, listed on the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. And I went to California about once a month to, you know, talk to the bosses.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is a pretty sizable brokerage, I guess. Is that right?
Well, sizable in those days, sizable today, not even a blip in today's idea of size.
But pretty different from this joint account that you were working on.
Oh, very different, very different, because we had offices, brokerage offices. We did investment banking. We did minor syndicate work.
How did that change your function as a specialist?
Not at all. None. I mean, basically, I was running my division of Mitchum, Jones, and Templeton, which is what it was. It was the East Coast trading operation.
Okay. So at some point, you decided to set up for yourself. Is that right?
In 1980, the principal shareholder of Mitchum, Jones, and Templeton, a guy by the name of Rick Guerin, who's dead. I don't know if Rick's dead. That's probably not true. Scratch that. I'm not sure Rick is dead. Wanted to get out of the trading business. And he basically said to me, take your East Coast trading division and get out. And he did the same thing with the West Coast trading division. There was a specialist firm on the floor of the Pacific Coast Stock Exchange. Back in those days, both San Francisco and L.A., we had operations in both cities. And so it was all spun out, if you want to call it that. And that was 1980. And in 1980, I founded something called Agora Securities. And what we did, basically, Ken, was just change the name on the door. Nothing else changed. And then I went to London looking for some outside capital and found a firm there that was then called Smith Brothers, not the cough drop people, but bona fide brokerage firm. And they became a 25% shareholder, 24.999% shareholder in Agora Securities, which caused less problems with the exchange in terms of control. So that's why they were not a 25% owner.
They didn't
want to be, and the exchange wasn't excited about having somebody that was a non-New York firm in those days owning 25% of a specialist firm.
Was that an arbitrary number, 25%?
Probably. It was probably driven more by IRS than anything. Mm. It probably had more to do with reporting and those kinds of things, how you'd factor in taxes for a British company. Anyway, Smith Brothers became Smith Newcourt, and then Smith Newcourt was bought out by, that was the Rothschild family, and they were bought out by Merrill Lynch, and then we all know the Merrill Lynch story thereafter.
Okay. Well, we've got the genealogy down a little bit. Let's track back and talk about the 60s, and you talked about your tech stocks, and you know, that just sort of rings all the chimes of that period, the go-go period where the market's really taking off in a way that nobody'd seen before.
Well, I think that was a much briefer version than the 90s version of electronics and technology. But the 60s were interesting. Volume was starting to pick up on the exchange. I mean, you had days that we were really actually kind of busy instead of sitting around, you know, shooting the breeze and doing whatever they were. The exchange was a little bit more playful in those days than it became later on. The practical jokes were significantly greater in the 60s.
So you had time for personal interactions.
Exactly. You could talk and you could BS.
Where was the volume coming from?
Volume was coming from the big stocks, the General Motors type stocks, the bigger Dow companies. But even in those days, you could have a stock that, you know, was a secondary kind of company that would trade 300,000-400,000 shares a day, and that was a lot of volume. Mm-hmm. A lot of volume.
This institutional investors, is that not what's happening?
It's the beginning of it. It's just the beginning, I think, of the mutual fund and people taking larger positions in stocks.
And as I would assume that folks like you are looking to get, you know, to specialists are looking to get into the bigger stocks.
Wanted to get the allocations, yes.
How do you do that?
Well, in those days, it was very much more political than it became. Political in that the governors and directors of the New York Stock Exchange tended to get the better allocations. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And the firms without politically connected people got, shall we say, not as good selection of stocks. That's biased, but
you know. There was a committee or something, I would assume.
There was not an allocation committee to the degree that it existed in the 80s, 90s, and now. It was more of an old boy club, you know, boy, this one's yours, Ken, the next one's mine kind of thing.
Hmm. Well, what were some achievements for your organization then? You're in this regional firm, and you're obviously not connected at the top.
I started getting interested in politics at the exchange in probably the mid-70s.
Okay.
And the first political job I had at the exchange on the floor was floor official. And I think I became a floor official in maybe 76, 77. Mm-hmm. So I started to try and be more noticed, and by the way, I think also the allocations were getting more equitable by that stage of the ball game. I don't remember when they put in the first pure allocation committee, but I want to say it was probably the 80s when that happened. So we started applying for better stocks and getting some decent stocks. We got a company called Fleetwood Enterprises, which was a mobile home builder out in California. We got one of the gaming stocks. We got two or three REITs, one of which Great American Mortgage Investors, GAMI, was a monthly dividend-paying stock, and it got some volume around the dividend date every month. Mm-hmm. So we started to pick up volume and get better allocations.
And that's growing your business, I
That's
guess.
Growing the business, absolutely. Without horses to bet on, you have no race.
Right.
And that's what we wanted. We wanted more horses.
And I would assume that you had you were starting to get more horses when you started to get politically active.
Correct.
Because you're starting to take your, you know, move out of the day-to-day.
Right.
And that's really intriguing to me is, you know, what was behind the decision and what was involved in doing that. You just sign up for groups or tell people, hey, I'm available?
No, I think it was more being noticed. It was more being able to run active stocks and control crowds, which in those days, you don't see a crowd on the floor of the stock exchange anymore except rare opportunities at the opening or at the close with some huge imbalance. I had helped out in stock situations with other firms where they needed some help. And, you know, we had different kinds of things in those days. I remember the Tylenol scare with Johnson & Johnson. And at that time, I think I was a governor of the exchange, which was the next step up in the pecking order. And I went over and helped that with Donnie Stone and another friend of mine, a friend who's remained a friend over many, many years. They needed some help, and I stood around and pitched in when needed.
What do you do? How do you control a crowd?
Well, you basically get them all to quiet down, and you get buyers to announce their buyers and sellers to announce their sellers, and you try and bring them together. That was the classic old New York Stock Exchange model. Bring buyers and sellers together and only have the dealer there when needed to, you know, take a piece of the imbalance, or in the case when there were an absence of buyers or an absence of sellers, to have the specialist step in with his or her own capital.
Right.
I mean, that was the classic model. That doesn't exist anymore today, as you well know.
Right. Right. Which has been much discussed in recent
days. And being discussed right now as we sit here talking.
So somebody just, they notice you, you get more visibility, and somebody says, hey, how would you like to be a floor official?
Exactly.
Is that the way it works?
Yeah, it's sort of the way it works. So, the directors in those days anointed the floor officials, and then, as I say, this next step was governor. There were 16 governors on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, mm-hmm. 8 specialists and 8 brokers. I was one of those from, oh, I would say from 82, 3, 4 to 1990, 91, and then I ran for director in 1992. And there were 3 directors on the floor of the exchange, 2 specialists and 1 broker. And I became one of those 2 specialist directors in 1992, sat on the board. I was a director of the exchange.
So there was, there were slots for 2 specialists?
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. Tell me a little bit about the floor official job.
Floor official job was more, each tier had things that they could do and couldn't do. With a floor official job, you could approve stop loss orders and accumulation of stop loss orders. So a stock is trading down from 30 to 29. The specialist has gone on record with the exchange that there's this accumulation of stop loss orders at $29 a share, and if it sells there, they're going to be elected and then become basically market orders to sell stock. You know how a stop loss order works?
Yeah, tell me.
A stop loss order works to protect the purchase you made. So you bought IBM at 100 and it's now gone to 130. And you say, gee, if this stock trades back down to 125, I want to lock in my profit.
So you
automatically put a stop loss order in to sell at 125. Okay. And when it first ticks at 125, your order then becomes a market order to sell the stock. And you get the next price. It could be 124.5. It could be 125. It could be more dramatic like last Thursday. Mm-hmm. It could be any combination of things, but the specialists went on record when they had these big accumulations of stop loss orders, and then they would get a floor official, or depending on how truly dramatic it was, maybe a governor in there, and we would rule and try and bring buyers in and let everybody know and take a minor timeout, if you will, a minute or two, to determine what was a fair price for those stop loss orders. I mean, there was a feeling that they were there for the specialist's, you know, ability to get rich. Because if he could quickly pick them off at 124 and the stock went back to 125, he'd had a good day's profit.
Mm-hmm. But that would have been their function, in essence.
Their function would have been to pick the right price. And if they picked a dramatically bad price, they were going to go before regulation. And the right. last thing you wanted to do was see the regulators.
Right. Yeah, tell me about the regulators. I mean, the exchange had its own regulators.
The exchange was a self-regulatory organization.
Were
it still is.
Were they considered the regulators? Is that who you're talking
about?
Yeah,
but with a reporting function to the SEC. The SEC had the ability to come in and ask for any piece of paper they wanted at any time, and we provided it. And they would, you know, come in, well, I mean, come back to 87 a second. Let's digress.
Sure.
In 87, there were a whole bunch of stocks that were analyzed very, very thoroughly from the standpoint of, did the specialist stand up and commit capital, or did he walk away?
Right.
And there were some stocks reallocated, which means that the specialist was considered not to have done his job.
What happened to those specialists?
They were all still there. The firm that I merged with in 1990 lost the stock after the 87 mess. Spearleads and Kellogg, which was one of the biggest and best, lost the stock, and it didn't have any impact on Spearleads and Kellogg's ability to ultimately sell themselves to Goldman Sachs. And Peter Kellogg, who's a personal friend today, built a marvelous business. I mean, they just...
But the perception was that somewhere in there, one of the specialists didn't do his job.
Job that day, exactly.
Supposedly, there were a lot of folks who were unable, if unwilling, to do their job.
Well, I think that was a reflection of, A, the time, and B, the amount of capital. And the exchange did a marvelous job after 87 of ratcheting up the capital requirements, and they kept ratcheting up through the 90s and into the aughts, ratcheting capital requirements today, because there, in essence, there is no more specialist. The capital requirements have been diminished to some degree. They're more designated market makers like you would have in options and futures today than they are what I would call the classic specialist model.
And people putting together these joint accounts wouldn't be able to come up with that kind of capital, I would assume.
They would come up with small capital. I mean, I'll give you the classic number. In 1987, we had about $10 million of cash capital and borrowing power of four times that, so $40 million. That was what you could borrow, up to 25%. Probably the first thought that went through my head after 1987 was, is A, we didn't have enough money, and B, where was I going to get it? And that's what began the consolidation phase, as specialists realized first that they didn't have enough money for these dramatic moves, and Lord knows 500 points on the Dow was a dramatic move from 2,500 down. It's a little less dramatic from 11,000 down, but that's when the first thoughts, I think, started to run through those of us that were in our 40s and 50s maybe in those days, thinking about the future of our firms and the future of our businesses. And that's what drove me to merge Agora into LaBranche, which I did in 1990, the 2nd of January, 1990.
So it sounds like you started looking around right after.
You should ask my daughter this question, because she'd give you a different answer. My daughter would probably say to you, I was scared, I was petrified, I was thinking about my own future in the business and what was Tuesday going to bring after the Monday, October 19th crash, which we never used the word crash, by the way. It was always a correction.
Okay.
It was always a correction. Never anything that rhymed with bash or dash or clash.
Okay. I thought it was okay to call it a market break.
Market break. Break's probably all right. Break, you know, break, you break a bulb, you break a plate, you break the market, you break the bank.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was the driver, Ken, for most of us that were sitting there. And remember, at this time, in 1987, I've got a firm that's trading close to 40 stocks. We have five partners, what I would call basically full partners, and then three or four or five junior partners, depending on the time. And maybe a total firm of 22, 3 employees in all.
And the partners and junior partners are all on the floor.
They're all on the floor. Well, we had some upstairs people doing clearing and administrative partner. A gal, actually had dinner with her last week. This is a gal I hired at 23, 22 right out of college. And she's still working for a specialist firm, which is great. That's 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the beginning of the thought process. Not only the loss, because we lost about 30% of our cash capital that day, not only the loss, but more, I guess, thinking about the future and how were you going to survive if another one of these events happened? Could you take another 20 or 30% hit on your capital? But more importantly, it was really basically in those days all our own money. There was no real outside money, no public firms. LaBranche goes public in the late 90s as really the first big specialist firm to go public. Others had done joint ventures. There was a book that merged with Bear Stearns, and they were a public firm. And even Goldman, I mean, Spearlead sells out to Goldman. It's probably got to be very late 90s, early 2000s before Spearlead sells out to Goldman. And they're a private, they're still a partnership in the classic sense of the word.
The question becomes, why did you think this might happen again? I mean, you know, one would think, well, this was a once-in-a-lifetime experience. But did it seem like the market was getting more and more volatile, more and more money was going in and out?
You didn't have the same frenzy that you had in the late 90s with the technology bubble. It was more, as I remember, 87 to me was more of a political event. The dollar was in basic free fall. There was obviously an overvaluation of stocks, but it wasn't the same frenzy. It wasn't the same panic that I think that you saw in the late 90s.
So, I guess.
So you asked the question, I guess. Why do you think that this can happen again? Because I think that's the first thought that goes through the rational, paranoid brain, you know, and not that anything, not that they're even a sequitur, rational and paranoid, but I think you've got to think, oh my God, I lost this kind of money. A, how am I going to recoup it? And B, can I afford to have this happen again?
Yeah. You talk about, and clearly things accelerated after 87 for all the reasons you talk about. Had there been an incremental change up until then? Were you seeing some merging of some of these small groups?
Minor, but much more dramatic after the 87 debacle.
Okay. So this is sort of a quantum shift at that point.
Exactly. And we talked a lot to one another. We had a group of about a half a dozen of us. Let's see, in 87, what am I? 48 years old, right? 87. I was born in 39. I'm 48 years old. So there are half a dozen of us that are running medium-sized firms that are all in our 40s and 50s that are thinking, A, how long are we going to be doing this? Are we going to be doing this into our 70s? Are we going to be out of this place in our 60s? So we're thinking not only about survival, we're thinking about our own ultimate retirement, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Which helps to when you're thinking about merging into a larger company.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. So that's a factor that I hadn't ever encountered before.
I believe that. And let me tell you something we did with junior partners, too, because I think I learned this from Kellogg. And Peter was as bright a guy as any I've seen. We took all of our junior partners and we moved them from being a trading assistant to getting a white badge and becoming a specialist. They were required to put up capital in the firm. So what we did was we started withholding some of their money so as they became more senior as trading assistants, so that they would have some dough to put into the firm to, in essence, buy their percentage of the firm as we brought them out front, which was sort of a minor league to major league move, but also building, so they didn't run out and spend the newfound wealth they had as junior partners. Mm-hmm. They were withholding a piece for capital in the firm.
Okay. And was this something that other groups did?
We started talking about that, all of us, the younger people, the people, as I say, in 40s and 50s, about how to build the capital of our firms. And that was even prior to the 87 crash.
Hmm. Okay.
So I think it must have been a niggling thought, Kennan, in the minds of some of us. You know, how are we going to continue to grow capital? How are we going to get young people to be able to buy our shares of firms?
Now, you're talking about a generational change here, and you're talking about your young people, but from the governance of the exchange, I would assume that your colleagues would have been considered young people at this point.
We were probably, by the old fogies, considered snot-nosed little kids, you know. But by that time, the mid-80s, you've got directors and governors of the exchange that are all in their 40s and 50s. I mean, I think most of us thought that we were going to be well off of the floor of the stock exchange by the time we were 60. Mm-hmm. It's the only the Jimmy Maguires that are still there at age 70, whatever the heck Jimmy is,
right,
that want to still be there. I think all of us thought that there was life after 11 Wall Street that we wanted to participate in.
Well, did you see a point... you know, back in the 60s, I guess Keith Funston was still there. And
own a share of America.
Yeah, right.
That was the tagline.
The great PR man.
Right.
And did you see a point, any of these generational shifts in the leadership of the exchange? Was that ever perceptible to you and your colleagues?
Probably not until the 80s. Probably not in the 60s. I was far too young and juvenile to really be thinking that far out. Mm-hmm. Probably more into the 80s when it begins to cross my mind, oh my Lord, you know, the other generation is gone. I'm now about to run a firm. I mean, I founded Agora. Mm-hmm. I was 41 years old when I founded the firm, so...
You probably weren't taking a real hard look at the governance of the New York Stock Exchange.
No, not then, but later, yes.
You must have been thinking about it a little bit as you go. You talked about becoming politically active in the 70s.
Well, it looked like the right thing to do in terms of allocation. And then, of course, the allocation process became a committee process where you made an application, a bona fide application, mm-hmm. and it became less political and more realistic. Can this firm handle? Do they have the capital? Do they have the manpower? Do they have the talent? Do they understand anything about this industry, particularly as technology starts to get more interesting and we get listings on the exchange? So the committee process made allocations much fairer.
Mm-hmm. Where else did you see the committee process at work?
Oh, I think you saw it in technology, and that I was very, very involved with due to a friend who was at that time a director when I was a governor, and he basically pointed me towards technology and said, I want you to get very involved because paper and pencils are going the way of the dodo bird. And papers and pencils, 87 taught us. We had just introduced our first touch screen in the late 86 or early 87. And our firm, Agora Securities, on October 19th was 100% electronic to the degree that we had a book. And I found out that we had far less problems than some of our peers that weren't 100% electronic. And I knew then that that was the answer. And I'd had that drilled into me by smarter people than I was that were on the board and were very interested in it as well.
Do you remember who they were?
Oh, sure. Jim Jacobson, who lives right down the block. Peter Sullivan was a director. Michael Cream, guy that lives out in New Jersey, Donnie Stone, these guys were all directors of the exchange.
Were you on the committee then, the technology
I ended up on the committee and then ultimately running it.
Okay.
For a while.
Tell me about.
Well, it was more how do you go? What's the next step? The original technology was touch. It was a touch screen, and then we basically went to a keyboard technology with IBM. And the exchange would send groups of us up the Hudson yeah. River to IBM's headquarters, where we'd spend time with them looking at screens and talking about what we thought the ultimate answer was, and decided that keyboard technology was better than touch.
Now, you're talking about technology, and the assumption is that you're really looking to replicate the same processes that the paper and pencil had, just with computers. But supposedly there are all kinds of other things you could do with computers, like change the process or change the system. Was there?
You know, more importantly than that, we learned in 87 was keeping track of our inventory. We didn't have good ways in those days for the computer to say, gee, you just bought 500 shares of IBM, you're now long 1,500 or 5,000 or 10,000 or whatever. So I remember the biggest concern I had on October 19th was how was I going to pay for all the inventory I had? And I was walking around the post to my partner saying, how many shares of XYZ do you think you're long? We were the specialist in Kroger. How many shares of Kroger do you have? How many shares of Mead Paper do you have? How many shares of this do you have? How many shares of that do you have? We knew there were no short positions. They were all yeah, long inventory.
Yeah.
And I was trying to figure in my head how much money. I had to go back upstairs that night and call the bank. And I told the bank, I said, I think we're going to need $40 million. And you could hear the audible gasp. We'd never borrowed $40 million. We had never borrowed more than $20 million from the bank. So here's suddenly this client in a free market fall that's going to have to borrow $40 million? Enormous amount of money.
Yeah.
And we can thank the New York Fed and we can thank John Phelan for the fact that on Tuesday the banks were told politely to ease up. And they did. I mean, they gave us all the money we needed to pay for those purchases, which in those days was a week later. We had to settle the trades of the 19th on October 26th. By that time, by October 26th, our positions weren't back to what they normally were, but we were out of the woods. We were breathing a little easier than we were on Tuesday when we had another market collapse, as you know, on Tuesday the 20th. That was the scary day. That was even in many respects scarier than the 19th, because on the 20th you had time to think. On the 19th, you were just reacting. You know, somebody was in your face, I want to sell 10,000 shares of Kroger, and make me a bid, make me a bid. And you made them a bid. And you prayed you weren't going to get hit, but more often than not, you bought the stock, and you ratcheted it down to the next level.
And on the 20th, was it just a matter of time? There was more time to think about what was going on?
You got that little blip at the opening, a little tiny rally at the opening, and then they started to go into free fall, and the exchange was shutting down stocks, particularly the big stocks, one by one. And so you got less busy as stocks were shutting down and as the other players in the marketplace, particularly with program insurance, they couldn't do those options trades without the underlie because you need some place to lay off your bet, right?
Right.
No place to go. So things sort of came to a quiet period, and then stocks reopened, and then late afternoon, the 20th, you got that marvelous rally, and everybody wiped their brows and said, you know, maybe we're out of the woods. And as it was, we were.
Anything we haven't talked about, highlights of the 60s, 70s period?
No, 60s, I think, are, you know, a growing, for me, it was definitely a maturation period of my life of growing up and understanding the business better and realizing that if I was going to make a career out of it, I better go do all the right things in terms of talking to my peers and understanding the business better. So,
what did you learn? These are the kind of things I want to try to pick up.
Well, I think you learn the sophistication of market making. You understand that market making is not so much an art or a science as is a matter of feel and doing what's right. I mean, I get a kick. I was on the SEC's website the other day. I got to read you this. And this is something that's the mission of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission is to protect investors, maintain fair and orderly and efficient markets, and facilitate capital formation. That's an interesting charter, you know, mission statement. Mm-hmm. Our job was to maintain fair and orderly markets.
Right.
And what was fair in IBM wasn't particularly fair in a stock that traded 500 shares a day when IBM might have traded 500,000 shares a day in those days. So you had to learn the fine-tuning of the difference between a big Dow stock and a secondary stock that might trade 2,500 shares in a day, and that was all it traded. So you wanted to maintain a balance of inventory and not get yourself too extended in that secondary or tertiary stock that didn't have the same liquidity profile.
But you'd have to take some because that's your function.
That was the function, exactly. So how do you measure it? How do you figure out what the proper market-making responsibility is? How do you figure out which of your partners are going to do... Step back. Stocks are like children. Here's your analogy. Mm-hmm. Stocks are like children. Each one takes a little different something to raise. Mm-hmm. I think about R2. And, you know, which one needed more hand-holding, which one needed more communication, which one needed more, you know, patting on the head. Stocks are, your partners are like that, and stocks are like that. Then from the standpoint of a business model, our specialist firm was a grocery store. We stocked up the shelves every morning with canned goods and bread and dairy products and meats. You pick the products here. And today, you know, they might like the canned goods, and you did well trading the canned goods, but boy, the meats weren't going off the shelf very well, and you had to watch your inventory of meats because you didn't want to get stuck with inventory that was going to turn bad on you and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
you got
yeah.
the analogy.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the thinking that I went through in the 60s and 70s, sort of as an analogy of how the business was. As the business grew, that became less and less, you know, relevant because you had more stocks, first of all, you had more horses in the race, but also you had more volume and more liquidity.
Right. Things are trading a lot more.
Yeah, they're trading better. Better is the right word.
Were there benchmarks?
Had guidelines.
Okay.
We had definite spelled out guidelines that...
From the exchange?
From the exchange. Oh, yeah. Computer models. All these bright guys from MIT came in and did computer models for us.
How well did they work?
They worked well in normal times. Mm. They weren't nearly as tasty, delicious in times like October 19th, 1987, because you get burned.
Anything else we should talk about as far as the early period? I do want to sort of follow you through your political involvement and coming up from walking around on the floor and sort of policing the precinct, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good term. That's what we were. We were, you know, flat-footed cops as floor officials, and then you moved on up. You might have been a detective as a governor and whatever the next great up captain as a director of the exchange.
But
good analogy.
Well,
I like it.
A more direct analogy, of course, is there's guys in surveillance too running around.
Exactly.
How much would you interface with them?
If you did a good job and kept your nose clean, never. I mean, you filed reports. First of all, I mean, we filed trading reports weekly. And then if they wanted to dig deeper into what was going on in a particular stock, they'd come in and they'd take your order flow and they'd do a reconstruct of where you stepped in and when Merrill Lynch came in to sell 5,000 shares and how did you interact with Merrill Lynch's broker and what did you do for him to try and make him feel good about his getting a good price for his customer. That's maintaining fair and orderly markets.
Did everyone in your group or your colleagues, did everybody take a sort of a sanguine view of what was going on? One would think that it was a little strange having your own policeman in your own house, and that there might have been mixed.
Yeah, it's a different model. There's no question about it. But yeah, we knew sanguine, probably not a bad word. That was the rules under which we played, and so we knew that if we stepped outside of the guidelines, if we didn't perform the function for which we were supposed to, that we were going to get hauled up in front of the regulators. And as I told my good friend Ed Qualwasser, who was the head regulator there at the exchange, the less I saw Ed, the happier I was. As we ended up, we became partners working for the exchange itself, which is the other half of this story that you'll get to when I come off of the floor to go work for the exchange itself.
Then committee work. You talked about technology.
There was a group that was working on how do you communicate with your companies. Another thing we learned out of the 87 mess was that there wasn't as good communication with companies as many of us thought we had. That we might have thought that we were doing a marvelous job. That can go bye-bye. That we might have thought we were doing a marvelous job and the company didn't think we were doing a marvelous job. So that got tightened up, too, and there were requirements on what levels of management you had to talk to, all as a result of 87.
Is this essentially reporting type of stuff?
No, it's more, it's answering their questions. We probably needed to better realize that even though we didn't work for Kroger Groceries or IBM or General Motors, we had a responsibility to that company to inform them, and it was generally the CFO, that was generally who you dealt with, of what was going on in the stock, who the sellers were, who the buyers were, and what we were trying to do to mitigate dramatic moves in the stock. So there was a much better, after 87, process for making sure your companies knew. And then we all, as firms, we hired people upstairs. And your downstairs trader would call your upstairs gal and say, call Kroger for me and tell them that I've just seen a 100,000 share seller in the stock. I think the stock is going down a point or two. Mm-hmm. So we told them, we warned them before the dramatic move happened, like last Thursday where Accenture had no idea their stock was going from 40 to a penny.
Right.
Okay. Bad.
Yeah.
Bad last Thursday.
I talked to Don Stone, and he really...
Donnie's a champ.
And he really personalized it in that you get to know the company that you're working for and the people.
You're not an insider, but they treat you like you are a part of the community with a piece of the puzzle that they need to know. and particularly for a CFO. I mean, it was the right place to. Some did it with the IR, PR type people. I'd like to go to CFO or CEO. You had some companies where the CEO contacted you directly, and God knows with a Donnie Stone what his relationship was with companies. I'm sure it was marvelous.
I think he did Tyler. He was right down the hallway with Tyler.
He was Tyler. I was right across the floor, directly catty-cornered across from him. So, you know, whenever Donnie needed a little help, or maybe he didn't need any help at all, I was standing around there to help if he needed it.
Did any of your stocks ever go through any gyrations or anything like that?
Not to the degree that we had some major product problem. No Edsels or Tylenols or things like that.
No bad news.
No, well, you had bad news. I mean, we had a stock go to zero. We were the specialist in Continental Illinois Bank. You know what happened to Continental Illinois Bank. So we had our fair share. We had a company called Famous Artist Schools. I remember taking a significant position in the stock at $4.50 and thinking I had bought it very, very cheaply, and it went to zero. So, you know. We had our, but nothing that got sort of the visibility that a Tylenol got. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that company handled it beautifully.
Yeah.
I mean, that's your classic, how to do it right. Pull it off the shelves, warn everybody, do it beautifully.
Yeah. Which is unusual, maybe, because it was really one of the first times something like that happened. So you became a governor, and your purview is a little more broad at
Correct.
That point, I guess.
I can do more things. I can actually halt trading in a stock as a governor.
Okay.
I can't halt trading in a financial stock, but I can halt trading in a manufacturing stock.
Why not a financial stock?
The perception was if you halted trading in a Citigroup, that maybe there was something more dramatic there than met the eye, and so they wanted directors involved. They wanted Donnie Stones involved in the financial stocks when he was a director of the exchange for many, many years.
Okay. Was this starting to become something like a full-time job at that point?
Not as a governor, I think as a director of the exchange, which I was from 92 until 96 when I came off the floor of the exchange to become president, I think it was a darn near a full-time job. I ran a panel of stocks, Ken, but they were really very, very inactive, and they were more relationship than anything. It was more a company saying to me, gee, we know you're busy, but we'd like you involved in the trading of our stocks.
Okay.
You know, there were no big stocks. They were all tertiary type companies.
Okay, so tell me about the director's day, the kinds of things that you would
Directors would generally have meetings every single morning. We would get together for lunch generally once a week, if not more, and talk about problems that we saw. And then there were meetings after the close. We all had committees on which we sat as directors. Most all of us went through the regulatory committee, and Stone, when he was vice chairman, made sure we all did that. And what we did, and Betsy used to get quite a kick out of this, was I would come home with piles of paper of regulatory issues. A registered representative at a member firm had churned grandmother's account, and we looked at those things, and some of them were appealed to this committee that I sat on, and we had to be reasonably well-versed on what their job was, and we did it. I mean, we looked at all of these things and we opined on them, and some went back to be retried and some we upheld their ruling, the committee, and then it would go to the board of the exchange in certain cases, and they would uphold or not uphold the ruling that had been originally made by an arbitration panel.
Is this the governance committee? Is it?
Yeah, there was a governance committee.
Okay, because in the old days, the governance committee was the the power in the exchange.
Yeah, before my time.
Okay.
Very definitely before I get involved in the
politics
of the
exchange. So now you're looking at the board.
Now you're looking at the board at least having some oversight, some view of it.
Okay.
And remember, the board changed it in the, and I don't know the exact date on this, and Stone could give it to you, but I want to say it was probably mid-70s. You go from a board that was alternating with the chairman between a floor guy and a upstairs guy to a full-time chairman of the board. Going way back to the Funston types, they were presidents of the exchange. They were not chairman and CEOs. They were president and CEOs.
Right.
They were not chairman of the board. The chairman always came from the industry, either the floor or one of the member firms.
Okay.
And that changes, and then you start the governance climb of, you know, making this thing better run, better regulated.
When do you think that climb started?
Probably mid-70s, probably in that time frame. Stone would have a better answer for you.
Well, it's interesting to describe it that way. Mm-hmm. The question would be, what do you think was behind it? Is there public relations involved? Is there a sense that the market is changing so fast that we've got to get our act together here?
I think the market's changing. The technology is changing the market. You're getting much more volume. You're getting more players in the market. You're getting a mutual fund industry that's growing by leaps and bounds. You haven't gotten to hedge funds yet, but you're getting people that are getting more interested in the market, and you need that level of confidence, that layer overhang, you know, of ability to check on people that are doing erroneous things. Don't get me into Bernie Madoff. I'll talk for 2 hours about Bernie.
Well, if there's anything particular you want to say about that,
we'll think about that.
Yeah. Your decision to really go full time then in the governance.
Products are getting more interesting too. That's crucial. Options coming into business. You've got this ability to hedge and to trade differently. There always have been options, but not to the degree that the CBOE brings it to a whole new level. Brodsky. These guys they're going to create product for us because they want a place to hedge their positions. So they're going to create more volume for us. Mm-hmm. So the products are becoming more sophisticated, more interesting.
And at the same time, you've got the rise of the NASDAQ, which is maybe sparking a little more interest in investing and all that sort of thing. At the same time, there's something of a competition that starts generating.
Oh, heck yes. And still a competition.
Yeah. That's part of, I guess, the banging heads together in Washington.
Although
they
kissy-kissy as of yesterday, supposedly.
I read the headlines.
And they've got to have. I mean, the long story is you've got to have the same rules across all markets. The SEC has got to get this message and get it right. I mean, in the old days when the stock exchange had 85% of market share, you know, you concentrated all your efforts on making sure they were running the business properly.
Right.
Today, you've got peripheral marketplaces that are doing 5, 10, maybe more percent of the volume, and they've got to have the same rules as the exchange.
Right. Well, in 87...
Or the exchange has got to have the same rules as them. I don't care whose rules they are.
Right.
They've got to be the right rules and played on a level playing field.
Right. Well, one of the things about 87 was that the NASDAQ market makers just weren't picking up the phone.
Yes, and Mr. Greifeld the other day accused the New York Stock Exchange of the same behavior.
Mm. No.
True or false?
Yeah.
I wasn't there.
Yeah.
I don't know. In fact, actually, I was driving back out from New York City last Thursday and was shocked when I got an email pulling into my driveway saying, what's going on with the market? And it was 3 o'clock, and I didn't realize the market was down 1,000 points.
Yeah. Well, if you checked at 1:30, you wouldn't have noticed.
Exactly that. Right. They're down 200 or whatever they were at that time. Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the decision to move up to the governor and then the president.
Well, I think that I was interested in the mechanics of the exchange. And if you wanted to be interested in the business as a whole, you really had to move up the political ladder. Once again, I mean, Donnie Stone was a mentor to so many of us. I mean, you know, he's the guy that gives me the goose to, you know, get involved. Mm-hmm. You want to get involved? Come on. Here's the way you do it. Here's how you do it. And Jacobson, you know, who was also one of Donnie's mentees, you know, would say to me, come on, let's go out to dinner and talk about this business and talk about where we see it 5 years, 10 years down the pike. Those were great friends, great people to have as friends.
And so, because of that, you'd come to the attention of the higher-ups?
Exactly. And then I got to be known by heads of member firms and people in corporate America, and you start to get a name for yourself.
And would you run for governor? Would you say, I'm putting my name in?
You basically got tapped, but you ran in a sense that the directors signed off on you. And when you ran for director, that was a political race. I mean, that was a vote by the membership.
Right.
So I was elected a director in June of 1992.
How did your perspective change? Was there a point at which you said, oh, I never realized that was happening that way before, or something? As you start to get, you know, get up higher and higher and have a different view of the exchange?
Yeah, for me, it was just a continuum of the learning process that I wanted to understand. I wanted to understand the evolution of an order. So I would go to mutual funds and spend some time with them and sit with their trader and sit with their research people. I would go to member firms and sit with their traders and try and understand how they were going to get an order. Mutual fund A gives brokerage firm B an order to buy 100,000 shares of IBM. How are they going to execute that order? Are they going to break it up? Are they going to give it all to the broker on the floor? Are they going to look for people that might have been sellers in their own customer base? All of these things, you know, from the chicken to the egg, mm-hmm. and the egg back to the chicken, maybe, from the standpoint of understanding the clearing process, the settlement process, and the incubation of that first idea. Gee, IBM looks cheap here. We want to buy shares for our mutual fund in IBM. Where did that idea come from? What caused it to spark? What then caused this reaction, you know, of buying the shares? That's education. I mean, come on, you know that best than I do.
So you're looking at the machinery and seeing how it
exactly
really works.
And how do the pieces all fit together?
When you're doing that, I mean, that's got to be a fascinating exercise. But when you're doing that and you're talking about it with your friends, you know, we're also talking about a time when, as you mentioned, technology is changing like crazy. The market is changing. Were there points at which people focused and said, you know, this just isn't going to, we can't keep doing it this way, or this change
well,
is going
87, to come? 87 eliminated pencil and paper. After 600 million shares down 500 points, I don't think even the hardest core people realized that technology wasn't the answer. We had to get out of the, you know, horse and buggy days and get into, and NASDAQ had helped us with that, despite we never saying anything nice about NASDAQ.
Right.
They had a technology process.
But what else? Were there other issues? Where did you, even if it wasn't technology, when you're looking at this, that the exchange in these years, were you seeing things that you felt were going to have to change in order for the exchange to keep up?
Yeah, but I think they were more buried deep down, and that 87 was really the catalyst for me to really think about the future, to really think about capital, to really think about technology, to really think about market making.
How about regulation and surveillance and all that stuff?
I never, lost major amounts of sleep over regulation. I figured if I kept my nose clean and did my job, that I'd be fine.
Right, but what about as a challenge for the exchange? I mean, something the exchange has to do, and it has to do it well.
Well, they did it after 87. Once again, they ratcheted up capital. They ratcheted up communication requirements. And I think the exchange encouraged, and I know John Phelan did and Grasso, encouraged mergers to get rid of these little mom-and-pop businesses. There was no room for mom-and-pop businesses.
Right.
They had to be run like bona fide grocery stores.
Supermarkets.
Yeah. There you go. Walmart.
Right. Well, how about the presidency? Tell me about the process.
Of how I became president of the exchange?
Yeah. And
I was in the wrong spot at the wrong time. Dick, I'm on the board in 1995 when Dick becomes chairman. Dick told a board meeting in early 95 that he would have a president in place because there was none. He had really held the job even as vice chairman to Donaldson and president. I don't know how many titles Dick had in those days. He had executive vice chairman. He had a bunch of titles. Anyway, I had moved up to vice chair from the floor in June of 96. June of 95. And that really was a full-time, for Stone, it was a full-time job. I mean, come on, Stone was everywhere, at every meeting, doing everything. And I found out you couldn't run a firm and be vice chairman at the same time. So I basically, started to walk away from the firm. It was April of 96 when Grasso came to me and said, I want you to come off the floor and become president and chief operating officer. And I sort of said to Dick, what are you, nuts? I got 2 years left on the board. I'm going off the floor at the end of 2 years. I'd already thought about going off the floor. It was a young person's game. And in 96, what the hell am I by this time? I'm 57 years old. Yeah, I'm starting to think about there's light at the end of this tunnel regarding retirement. And I think she's probably pushing me to start thinking about it. And he said to me a couple of times over the course of a day, I'm serious about this. And so he said, meet me in my office tomorrow morning. I had an office on this sixth floor of the Stock Exchange building as vice chairman, sort of across the hall from Dick. And I met him the next morning and I said, gee, Dick, I don't know. And he told me all the reasons why he thought I should do the job. And I told him all the reasons why I thought he had better people to do the job. And he had an answer for everyone that I suggested. And he said, go home, talk to Betsy about it. Think about it. So I came back a couple of days later and said, okay, let's talk about how long and whatever. So that was the job. And
then so what was his
name to the board? And I think Dick wanted, at that stage of the ball game, and I doubt after I held the job that anyone ever would have it again, someone from the floor that had a reaction. I think he saw the floor changing dramatically. And whether Stone helped in all of this, which he probably did, knowing Donnie, the idea that the floor had to continue to grow, had to continue to change, and the technology had to continue to come in, that we had to ratchet it up. Mm-hmm. As I said to you, the biggest thing that I learned out of 87, technology-wise, the biggest lack that we had in those days was the fact that I didn't know what my inventory was instantly. I wanted to know instantly. I'm now long 10,000, I'm now long 11,000, I'm now long 12,000. Why couldn't the machine give us that?
Right.
And Stone and Jacobson got that for us.
How long did it take?
Not very.
Yeah.
Not very.
It doesn't sound too complicated.
That's right back to IBM and saying, okay, yeah, you know, put another bell or whistle on this thing.
Right. So your presence as a floor trader, as a specialist, was important.
Yeah, I think so. From Dick, I think that we, how does one say this without sounding snooty? I mean, Dick knew I was interested in the business. I think Dick knew I didn't want his job. Mm-hmm. I had no desire to be chairman of the board of the New York Stock Exchange or work as hard as Grasso did.
Yeah.
Never. I mean, I was thinking about the exit door, Ken. I was thinking about, you know. And as it was, I probably stayed around longer than she would have liked or I would have liked. I stayed around until the end of 03.
So, in some sense, was this, he was looking for an ability for someone to talk to the
customers. I was good with the floor. I think that was my strength. I was good with the floor and I was good with the customers. I like customers. I learned early in my career, without a customer, you don't have a business. And this goes back to the grocery store analogy. Mm-hmm. If your wife doesn't walk into Kroger to buy that canned goods, they might as well close the door. So I wanted people that were interested in trading our stocks. The more trading that went through our stocks, the more ability I had to make an income. The more volume.
Right. So what was your job like then as president? With customers and the floor and...
Betsy would tell you I had no life. My life was subjugated to Dick. I mean, basically, I called on customers. I spoke academically. I've taught probably in over 100 colleges and universities across this country. I did a lot for him, backing him up on the international side. We listed probably 500 international companies in the 8 years that Dick was chairman of that board. I mean, he was marvelous on the international side. So for some reason, I got very interested in India as a country, and we got 10 or 12 listings from India. I spent a fair amount of time with those companies, telling them about the specialist process. I mean, I was a salesman. I was a salesman with a glorified title.
for the stock, New York Stock
Exchange. Stock Exchange, exactly. Yeah. For listings, for customers to come there, to make sure that everybody was performing their function on the floor.
Yeah, I had international and did that change things at all, the viewpoint of the exchange, the fact that the whole show is not right here in New York.
Oh, anymore. I think that was Dick's vision, definitely, that you were going to see ultimately around-the-clock trading to some degree, maybe not the way it's done in T-bills or commodities, but you were going to see a movement of market-making around the globe. I had already done that with a London market maker. I mean, I had already given them positions. We were the market maker in Glaxo. We were the market maker in Philips not petroleum, but Philips Electronics. We were the market maker in Total. We were the market maker in Benetton. We were the market in Club Med, all of which had their primary listings abroad or somewhere else. And so, I mean, I would give my positions to a European broker overnight and say, okay, here's where I want to buy and sell Glaxo, and I want to be a seller of much more at this price and a buyer of less at this price. Do that every night.
Wow.
And that was just inventory.
So you're handing off the baton.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But in a much less formal way than what you have today. I mean, today Merrill Lynch will make you in a market in any stock around the globe at any time if you're a good enough customer. You know damn well they will.
Right. Well, okay. This is the point. This is the time when NASDAQ gets in all kinds of trouble with their market makers scam.
Yeah, the odd eighth.
Yeah, the odd eighth thing. And some order handling rules come out of that, and things tighten up to some degree. Did the exchange see some changes from that general regulatory push that came out of that?
Yeah, you'd do better asking a Qualwasser that question than you do asking me, Ken. Mm-hmm. But yes, definitely. I mean, I think that we all realize there, but for the grace of God go we, particularly with the market-making scandal on NASDAQ. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the stock exchange has their own problems, as you know, in
right.
the early 2000s.
Right.
Although less heinous, I guess, is for a word. And in fact, finally, the judge throws most of the cases out. So
this is the stuff starting with Oakford and all of that?
Well, no, that's the floor broker scandal. That's right. The late 90s. Oakford is really basically a NASDAQ firm where they are clearing transactions for people on the floor that are $2 brokers primarily. And those brokers are buying and selling stocks without orders and illegally doing so. And then the orders are being clocked upstairs to cover their transactions. And what they had was they had a kid that was sticking blank pieces of paper into a time clock every minute or 30 seconds or whatever. So they had a whole bunch of paper there that could cover when I called upstairs and said, hey, Ken, I just bought 500 IBM at 1:33 minutes ago. You could take up the piece of paper 20 seconds before and write on there, buy 500 IBM.
Right. So that exposed some problem in the procedures.
The inner regulation of the exchanges. I mean, that was a NASDAQ firm that we didn't have the regulatory power of, and yet Grasso, God bless him, said to the brokers, without judge and jury, goodbye, don't let the door hit you. Hmm. You know, another big change you'll get a kick out of. When I was a kid, I remember them ringing the bell at the New York Stock Exchange and drumming them out of the core, ripping the epaulets
really?
Off. Yeah, you were publicly shamed, and you were escorted off the floor of the stock exchange if you had broken a rule, if you had done a Bernie Madoff. You were publicly
wow.
chastised.
You remember seeing that happen?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And any particular incidents that
no,
I
No, none that I remember. It was funny. I was thinking about that lying in bed the other night, thinking about you and thinking about this conversation and saying, boy, you know, that did a lot probably to deter some behavior.
Yeah. Well, I guess it goes back to the old club thing where the rules are, you know, sort of a mutually enforced. I know honor is very important here.
Absolutely. Your word is your bond. I grew up hearing that expression from my dad and went to a school with an honor system, and I've been back to that school any number of times to talk about your word as your bond.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't cheat. You didn't steal. You didn't rape widows and orphans.
Right.
You didn't pillage.
Right.
You didn't do those kinds of things. It just was frowned upon.
Well, so when the exchange starts to run into its problems then with trading
Oakford.
And all that stuff,
yeah.
Oakford, and the things that come in after that, did those things get worked on through committee? Is that the kind of thing you and Grasso would talk about?
Well, we talked about it, but no, most of it was handled by the regulatory side with the SEC, and the SEC knew that Grasso had thrown the people off of the floor of the exchange without trial, without judge and jury. And, I mean, I don't know what their reaction was because I wasn't politically involved in it in any way, shape, or form, but it didn't come back to bite us the way the specialist problem did. The specialist problem was a problem.
Tell me about it.
Well, the specialist problem was really basically the machine lights up. Now, you've got multiple orders coming in at any given time. Let's do this first in a NASDAQ. In a NASDAQ environment, you've got bid and offer exposed. A buy order pops up and it gets executed against the offer. A sell order pops up and it gets executed against the bid. In our model, you would try and pair those off. Some specialists opted to bunch all the sell orders, give them one price, bunch all the buy orders, give them another price, and make the spread on what they could interact on. That's a no-no. Mm. You got two orders there simultaneously, they interact with one another. That was our model.
Right.
And if buyer and seller both got better price, God bless, isn't that great? You know, if the stock was 130, bid offered at 130 and 10 cents, and they could interact at 130.05, that was marvelous. Each guy saved a nickel.
Yeah.
Damn, ain't that great? That was the model, Ken.
Right.
And I love that model. I think that model is fantastic.
How were people able to get around it, though?
They thought that the technology wasn't good enough to say that that sell order was there at the same time as the buy order.
Okay.
And the technology was good enough.
So the solution was the technology.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, hell, you know, that's simple. Your understanding. I mean, they're going to clock every order, not only to the second, to the millisecond. Now, were there times when you froze the book to interact with a group of orders and new orders were queuing up? Yes. And those orders weren't entitled because you were taking the two or five or ten orders before them. I mean, I've forgotten the word, it was something like clump or something like that, but your book would light up, you'd pick a price, and you'd print it. Your book would light up, you'd pick a price, you'd interact, and everybody got that price. So if IBM's trading 130 to a dime, you know, somewhere in that range, all of those orders were going to get executed. That's a great market model. Right. Today, the New York Stock Exchange looks like NASDAQ.
Right.
All buyers trade with the offer. All sellers trade with the bid. Rarely do you get price improvement. Rarely does buyer and seller both get a better price.
Was there a sense that that was coming in the late 90s?
Yeah, I guess there was a sense that was coming in the late 90s. NASDAQ encouraged that. The customers wanted speed. Mm-hmm. Now you've got this high-frequency trading, which for the life of me I can't spell, needless to say, understand what, you know, earthly good it serves in the world. But, you know, I read treatises that say it's good and it provides liquidity and all the rest of that. I think the jury's still out, but that's up to the SEC to figure out and not to me.
Right. When you left as president, I think you stayed on in some
role? I stepped down at the end of 01 as president. I stay on 02, 03 as a quasi-consultant, or I think my title was senior advisor. I spent half of year in 02 out in California. Our office out there had a guy running it that ultimately left. We weren't getting the listings from the West Coast that we thought we should be beating NASDAQ for. And so Grasso sent me out there and he said, figure it out. And, you know.
You're trying to pick up the tech stocks and things like that.
Picking up tech stocks, yeah. And other listings. I mean, it wasn't only tech, but tech was the big piece of it, yeah.
This is Menlo Park, I think, is where.
Well, we were Sand Spring, you know. We were in the whole Palo Alto. Yeah. We were in Palo Alto.
Yeah. It's the hotbed of all of that stuff.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet. So I spent all of 02 commuting back and forth. I spent about a half a year in California, Betsy, in 02. Probably about four
was
months in 03. No, 03 was my last year. We hire a new guy to run the office in mid 03. So my last job, my deal in 03, Ken, was as I was to work 6 months and I could take 6 months off. And I had told Grasso what I was going to do was basically I was going to take the summer off. And I spent 2 or 3 months in early 03 commuting to California, going out for a week or 2 weeks at a time and then coming back. And then I took the summer off, and then the whole Grasso thing blows up in September of 03. I had just gotten back from Delaware, where Betsy grew up, in 03 in September, and his assistant called me up and said, come over, and Dick wants to see you. And I said, I had a lunch date, and she said, cancel it. I remember that. And I canceled it. I went over, and she had some lunch for me there. And he said, am I going to survive? And I said, I don't know enough. I've been, you know, out in the boondocks of Fenwick Island, Delaware, which is a lovely place, a lovely little town above Ocean City, Maryland, where this one grew up. And I've been out of it, you know, for 3 months. I read the paper, but the paper doesn't tell you the flavor of all of this thing. And a week later, Dick is out. And then John Reed comes in. John Reed said to me after I was vetted by general counsel, he said, nobody knows the membership better than you do of the exchange. He said, I want a vote of 1,000 positive out of 1,366 for a new constitution of the New York Stock Exchange. And I was basically his ex officio campaign vote getter. So I spent a lot of time calling lessor members of the stock exchange to get them to turn out to vote. We'd never gotten a vote of more than 850 people in favor of anything.
Yeah.
But Mr. Reed got well over 1,000 votes for a new constitution of the stock exchange.
What were the hurdles?
The hurdles were finding the people and getting them off of their dead butts to vote and making them understand that, yeah, it was time to make this thing look like more like corporate governance. More like what Sarbanes-Oxley and others had said.
And the kinds of things the exchange had been asking.
Exactly. Companies to do. We weren't necessarily doing as well ourselves.
So in a sense, having been there all those years under the old constitution, your last job was to...
To write a new one. No, I didn't write it. I didn't have anything to do with the writing.
But to make sure it got...
Just make sure it got voted, got passed.
Was that your last involvement with the exchange?
My last involvement. That's fall of 03.
Okay.
And I have been out ever since.
Is there anything that we've missed that we should talk about? Stories, ideas, people you worked with, tough times, interesting times?
Well, I mean, I've given the speech, and you can probably find it online somewhere because I've given it a number of times, the two worst days of my life. To kids in colleges, and the idea is not to scare the bejesus out of them, to make them understand they're going to be lousy days in their careers, and the 2 days are 87 and 9/11/01. Two totally different days, and for me, two totally different jobs. I'm president of the exchange in 01. I spend the next 2 or 3 days spending all my time on the telephone with customers trying to find out their preparedness to reopen that Monday, the 16th, 17th, can't remember what day it was. The 11th was a Tuesday, so 10, 17th, that we reopened on the 17th. Making sure whether they had office space, if it was people that were downtown, making sure that the corporations knew we were going to reopen. I mean, I just dialed. Just spent my time dialing, talking to customers.
What happens if they weren't ready?
Well, we pretty much, and the SEC pretty much knew they were going to be ready. Yeah. They told them they had to be ready. So some firms borrowed space from others, and the firms, fortunately, there were no significant firms. I mean, Merrill Lynch was next door, as you know, and Morgan Stanley had some space. We had three floors in the South Tower. Did you know that?
Yeah,
28, 29, and 30. We had three floors in the South Tower, and the guy, the security guard over there, it's a marvelous story, got everyone out. The PA system was saying in the South Tower, stay where you are, everything's fine. He said, nonsense, out. Mm. He got them all out, went to bathrooms, closets, offices, you name it, got everybody out of that place. Marvelous story. Yeah. Marvelous story. I mean, whether they'd have been all right, God only knows. But, you know, just a guy with the brains.
Right.
And we were over there in the World Trade Center in the 93, 94, you know, garage mess. So there were people that had the joy of tasting both of those.
Yeah. Anything else?
I think not. I mean, I met everybody. Ken, the job, it was, President Exchange was a marvelous job. I mean, I met people that I never would have met. I met corporate America. I met politicians. I met actors and actresses. I had the pleasure of meeting literally everyone. It was it was a great thrill. I had the pleasure of escorting Mrs. Clinton around on 17th of September 2001. I had the pleasure of meeting her husband one-on-one for 5 minutes for a Martin Luther King Day. You know, I mean, just everybody and everything. They all paraded through. It was theater. The Exchange was theater.
Yeah.
Well, doesn't sound good, but, you know, the companies loved it. I mean, the PR. Grasso, like him, dislike him, love him, hate him, he could sell snow to Eskimos. He was the consummate marketer, marvelous marketer. Just wonderful ideas on how to promote companies, whether it's an E-Trade monkey on the floor or the, we had the Gateway cow, bull, whatever the hell that thing was. I mean, you know, dancers from European countries, just marvelous games. Marvelous marketing. What a theater. What a venue for companies.
Well, he certainly, you know, I guess wanted to give people the sense that the Exchange was not a private club anymore.
Yeah, and I think he did that well. I think he did that well.
Well, terrific. Thank you so much for talking to me today.
You're very welcome.